Excuse me. May it please the court, Brody White on behalf of Appellant GoBest, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
This case is about much more than just the initial illegal seizure of GoBest's property. What this case is really about is Metro and its policymakers' many decisions to illegally retain GoBest's property throughout litigation and then in defiance of 3 separate court orders. And it's the litigation here that's the key.
That doesn't sound like, I mean, the way you just framed it, that doesn't sound like a policy and practice. That sounds like you just said they made a decision about GoBest things. Don't you have to have a policy or practice that extends beyond your case to have Monell liability?
No, Your Honor, not under Pembar versus City of Cincinnati, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case as old as I am. Under that case, even a single decision from a policymaker to take a specific course of action can constitute Monell liability. Even in the absence of additional incidences, and even in the absence of an official policy. So in Pembar, it was a county prosecutor's decision to illegally search a premises. There was no other similar incidents, no policy. But because the county prosecutor was considered a policymaker for the municipality or for the county, it was deemed to be Monell liability. And this court has addressed that many times. And really here, it's inconceivable that policymakers for Metro were not involved in this decision. Whoever was calling the shots for Metro had authority to retain counsel, had authority to litigate in Metro's name, and had authority to use department funds to appeal the decision. Whoever was making those decisions was not a deputy officer or an evidence clerk. Whether it was Metro's general counsel or the sheriff himself, a policymaker was making those decisions.
Counsel, I think in the record there's a problem for this argument. So I'm looking at ER 12 and 13.
Yes. In the transcripts on the hearing?
Correct. And the court was asking about this issue, and the answer given back is, if your question is, has the sheriff ever come out and said it's our policy to retain these or this particular laptop, no. Mm-hmm. So, like, I read that as sort of disclaiming that there was a policymaker who actually made the specific decision at issue in this case.
I would respectfully disagree with Your Honor. It's not that we were denying that a policymaker was involved. It's just acknowledging where this case stood procedurally, which is on a motion to dismiss, where we did not know what a specific policymaker was saying at a specific time. The question here is, did we plead facts sufficient to plausibly suggest policymaker involvement? The court said, show me anything in the record where the sheriff wrote an email saying, I have your laptop, it's here, and I'm going to keep it. I believe that's what Your Honor's referring to. But that's imposing an improper standard. At this point in the pleadings, GoBest did not have the duty to plead, let alone provide evidence in the record that wasn't developed yet about what specific policymaker was making what decisions. The question is, do the facts suggest policymaker involvement? And they certainly do, because Metro was acting in its own name. And I want to look at a specific example. On August 4th, 2023, the Nevada Court of Appeals affirmed the lower court decision finding the seizure to be illegal and requiring Metro to return the laptop in 7 days. The Court of Appeals also lifted the stay of the order on that day. So Metro is under the absolute duty to return the laptop. Metro itself in the order, not an officer. It took Metro 161 days after that, 161, almost 6 months to return the laptop after that. That is a clear deprivation of GoBest's rights, and it more than plausibly was made by a policymaker.
So I want to drill down on this a little bit. Do we agree that this is a single incident case, and so the single incident rule has to be met here?
It depends on how you want to define a single incident, because
We don't have any indication or allegation that this has happened to other people, right?
We have not presented evidence of that yet, because we're just getting into discovery. And I don't think we're willing to concede that at a motion to dismiss stage, because we need to do discovery. But what I will agree is that our clearest route to liability here was most clearly alleged is the direct policymaker involvement here?
Okay, so then the answer that you gave a minute ago of this is at the pleading stage, and so we shouldn't be held to proving evidence. I mean, I understand that argument. What I don't understand is this answer that I read to you in the transcript, if that is the position that your client wants to take, because the answer could have been to the question that the court was posing about, you know, who's the decision maker who made this decision. The answer could be, you know, we haven't done discovery yet. And so we have a plausible theory, if you look at these facts, that there was a decision maker behind all of this. But that's not the answer that was given. The answer was given was very affirmative. If the question is, did the sheriff make this decision? The answer is no. The sheriff didn't.
Well, I mean, you know, like was said in the last case, you know, if we had 20/20 hindsight going back, you know, we may have done things a little bit differently, especially in the heat of the moment. I think what counsel meant to say there was, no, we don't have direct evidence that the sheriff made a decision yet. And if I were to make a better answer, it would be that the question is, do these allegations plausibly suggest a policymaker involvement?
Can you point me to a place in the complaint where you think there is a plausible allegation that indicates a decision maker is behind what happened?
Yes, I think it's in every paragraph of the complaint where we discuss what happened throughout litigation. So it's starting in paragraph 12 and moving through paragraph 21. So in paragraph 12, we allege that Metro was ordered to return the laptop. In paragraph 14, we allege that Metro did not comply with that. In paragraph 16, we allege that the Court of Appeals affirmed the lower court decision to return the laptop, and it did not comply with, and Metro did not comply with it. In paragraph 20, we allege that the Nevada Supreme Court denied the petition for rehearing. And in paragraph 21, we allege that Metro did not return the laptop until 64 days after the Nevada Supreme Court denied that petition for rehearing. And it's those allegations that really, when you take the facts of the case that we allege there and the reasonable inferences thereof, those allegations plausibly suggest a policymaker involvement because Metro was directly acting as part of litigation. And if you take those facts as true, GOBES pled a proper Monell claim. And I've reached my time.
You want to reserve the rest of your time?
Yes, I would.
Very well.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Christopher Kalkowski for the Appellee Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. And we ask that this court grant our motion to dismiss this appeal for lack of appellate jurisdiction, or alternatively, affirm the district court's dismissal of that Monell claim. Either way,
can
this
I
case
ask you, you know, I'm not sure whether there's a good vehicle here to provide relief, but I, you know, it's understanding that they would be frustrated at having had the Court of Appeals order the laptop returned, and then what was it? I'm not sure exactly the numbers because they count the numbers maybe slightly differently, but it's still months and months and months. So give me a good reason for why you didn't return the laptop other than just you're the government and nobody's going to tell you what to do.
It's certainly not that no one will tell us what to do. The focus is looking at the record and how much time has passed. So we, as a Metro, we did that motion to stay the decision to return the laptop during the appellate proceedings. And as counsel stated in the prior argument, there was 64 days between when the Nevada Supreme Court essentially eliminated the appellate process with this decision.
How often does the Nevada Supreme Court grant review for petitions from the Nevada Court of Appeals?
I don't have the statistics for you.
I argued one. I may have argued the only one. Back when I was Solicitor General, they rarely ever do that. So the odds, I mean, and I don't know that you had any, what was your rationale for keeping it during that period of time? I don't think you had a stay that lasted past the Court of Appeals, so maybe I'm missing that.
I believe that the motion to stay was for the appellate procedure, but after that, I want to focus really on the fact that in the record, there isn't any statement in the complaint or any reasoning provided that we were rejecting the court's decision for any particular set of facts.
It'd be pretty dumb if you, like, you know, issued a press release, you know, screw the Nevada Court of Appeals or something like that. But it just seems, I think it may be a lower probability of getting review from the Nevada Supreme Court of a of a Nevada Court of Appeals decision, discretionary review, than of the Supreme Court reviewing one of our decisions. But I'm not sure about that. But it's super low. So what was your reason for holding on a laptop during that time?
It isn't stated in the record, but the focus really with this comes back to the fact that we're just dealing with the Monell.
I asked you to give me a good reason, like why I shouldn't think you guys are bad.
And I don't have a reason for, Your Honor, from the record, but I can say that the focus today is just on the Monell liability, which is essentially, was it the sheriff, the policymaking official for LVMPD, making that decision to not return the laptop? And there are no allegations of that in the actual complaint. So the district court's decision to at least dismiss the Monell claim is 100% in line with precedent from this circuit, the United States Supreme Court, and all district courts.
Yeah, I'm not, like I said earlier, I'm not sure I'd disagree with you about that, but it still seems like you haven't given me a good answer for why you held on the laptop.
And, Your Honor, to address that specifically, is that's what the discovery process is for. But they still have to get past the plausibility standard to proceed with a claim. And they didn't have any actual defendants, individual
defendants.
Didn't the
court order you to, where you make a mirror of the laptop, keep a file of it, and then give it back? So I don't even, you would have had the files anyway. This poor, didn't have his laptop back during this time.
The record doesn't state that, but importantly, that would have been a process that could have been evaluated during discovery if they had.
I thought the record did say that the court had ordered make a copy of the laptop, keep that, but then give the laptop back.
Your Honor is correct, but the record doesn't say whether Metro was holding the laptop during that mirroring process and then returned it within this amount of time after that was completed. And really, the reason for the record not having that particular information, again, goes back to the fact that they still have to state a claim to get past the plausibility standard to then get to discovery and to evaluate those facts. But all of this really comes back to the core fact and the core focus of this case, which is this is just a Monell claim. So even if there was a violation of constitutional rights,
Monell lets you do bad things and not be liable. Would you agree? Like that's the whole thing about Monell. Cops can do bad things, and and if there's no policy, then their employer can't be liable. So, there's one view of Monell is it lets you do qualified immunity, lets you do bad things, things that we all maybe would, and not be liable, right? And and you keep going back to saying, please let us do the bad thing and not be liable. And I'm asking you, why did you not do a bad thing?
I know, Your Honor, I'll push back on
your answer is in the record, it doesn't reflect why we didn't do a bad thing.
I'll push back on
you see where that'd be kind of unsatisfying.
I see where
I'm giving you a hard time.
The focus is that that would be a legal mechanism to go after the acting officers, right? 1983 still allows a claim to be brought against the acting officers
Here the officer is a prosecutor that might have absolute immunity.
The prosecutor was not named as a defendant. And Metro, importantly, is just the law enforcement organization, not the prosecutorial agency. So with the 1983 claim that they could bring to name individual officers who are acting, that is one legal mechanism to
bring it against the officer that's making the individual decision to hold it even after there's a decision by the court, I guess.
If there was an individual officer, they could potentially bring a claim under 1983 under an individual capacity, right? Not a Monell claim, though. So there are these legal mechanisms where if they want to go after an individual officer or officers for violating rights in a single incident, 1983
they
absolutely
allows
that. They
know who that officer was in this case, right? Because, they don't, I think he was saying, we can assume that there was a policymaker. They don't really know who was making the decision to hold this thing after there's an decision from the Court of Appeals. So I guess they'd have to bring a John Doe type claim.
They did have Doe defendants, but importantly, it goes back to that focus of, they voluntarily dismissed their case after the Monell claim was dismissed. And so really we have two aspects to this. The Monell claim was correctly dismissed, absolutely, under this court's precedent. We looked at Doherty versus City of Covina, those cases where they're analyzing that, just saying a paragraph of the city did this and the city's policies caused this violation, that's just not enough. That's just conclusory allegations that this court's precedent and United States Supreme Court precedent has repeatedly rejected. And when we go then to the voluntary dismissal aspect, there was no finding from the district court that the claim was dismissed with prejudice, right? It was without leave to amend at this time, because based on the answers given by counsel during that hearing, there wasn't a basis to revive this claim or to believe that it could be plausibly stated. And so that the decision from Gobes then voluntarily dismissed all of their claims with prejudice essentially ends the analysis, right? It's static right there. So their voluntary dismissal ends it. the Monell claim was validly dismissed because there weren't any allegations that plausibly showed policies or procedures or a policymaking official involved. And then that's it. So all this court has to do to look at that is say, well, in line with our precedent, that was a valid dismissal of the Monell claim. That ends it. Or, more importantly, the voluntary dismissal of their claims didn't preserve appellate jurisdiction. I mean, really, what all litigants are supposed to do with the interlocutory decision process is go under Rule 54B or 28 U.S.C. 1292 to essentially ask the court to certify its decision so that if they want to stand on their pleadings at that time, they can take an interlocutory appeal process. Here they just voluntarily dismissed with prejudice, albeit, but without any of the district court's involvement, which completely flouts Rule 54 and 1292. And then also, they did so 64 days after, or I believe it was 82 days after, the district court's dismissal of their Monell claim. So there's no basis for that lack of diligence. And importantly, when case law is analyzing Section 1292 to see if this request for interlocutory appeal is timely, courts reject it for a lack of diligence. So if this voluntary dismissal process, at least in this context, were allowed, that would mean that essentially any litigant could just evade all of those procedures and run to the appellate court each time, even at the pleading stage. And a lot of this we're arguing about today is dealing with the fact that additional discovery could have potentially found facts to support a claim, possibly. But importantly, why would they then voluntarily dismiss it so early on? All of this court's precedent about allowing this voluntary dismissal with prejudice procedure occurs when there's essentially a dispositive, all-encompassing ruling by the district court so that nothing could really continue. For example, we look at the trendsetter decision from this circuit, and really the focus with that, and this is a quote, was that, however we decide this appeal, this case will be over. That's when the voluntary dismissal with prejudice route creates appellate jurisdiction. It just didn't do so here. And so they don't then get the luxury to then run to this appellate court and say, well, we should have had more time to evaluate this, or we should have had more time to investigate to see if we could have brought a claim. At the end of the day, the district court validly made its decision in line with precedent. As I mentioned, the Doherty decision is really right on point with these circumstances. Just referring to the city and saying policies and procedures were occurred because of the city practice is just not enough.
Let me ask something. So on the issue about whether we have appellate jurisdiction here for the reasons you said, look, Microsoft came out, big, bold statement, and our circuit is kind of chipped away, I guess, at Microsoft. But that's my commentary, not for you. It's not Article III jurisdiction. It's statutory jurisdiction, correct? So do we absolutely have to decide the issue? Let's say, hypothetically, we agree with you on the Monell issue, on the merits. Do we have to reach whether we have appellate jurisdiction or not because it's not Article III? Or can we assume, we'll assume jurisdiction, but we think the Monell argument's a loser. Can we do that, or do we have to, according to your view, do we have to hit that appellate issue?
I see that my time is ending.
No, you can't. You got to answer this one.
I was just going to say, man, briefly answer. With that, since it isn't Article III jurisdiction, as you're saying, then yeah, the court could in that event alternatively address just the Monell claim. But importantly, if it agrees with the district court's grant of dismissal, that is the end, right? They've waived any ability to ask for amendment or remand or anything like that. It's over. But to the extent that the court then addresses the voluntary dismissal aspect and agrees with that, that is also over, right? They've waived all their ability to try and get some type of remand. If the court finds it doesn't have appellate jurisdiction, that is the end of it.
Right. No, I understand, but there are some types of jurisdictional questions that are very hard that we have to answer. Yeah. And then there are some that are very hard that maybe we don't have to answer. This is in box two, correct, not box one.
Right. This is not something where the court would have to answer it, from my understanding of the law.
Why?
The reason for that is that this is under really a judicial doctrine of whether the court's going to allow appellate jurisdiction to exist. So does it evade normal rules of appellate jurisdiction to the point where the court, under its own doctrine, is going to say that we don't have that jurisdiction?
Well, as Judge Owens has talked about, this is all referencing Congress's finality requirement. And so, yes, we've got judicial work that has been done to flesh out this finality requirement, but it all does trace back to Congress's definition of the scope of our authority to act. So if that's true, why isn't this sort of similar to Article 3 in that this is talking about our power to act and not a prudential issue?
Right. It's a statutory discussion on whether it's sufficiently final in a sense, right? Is it final enough to where it falls within the congressional authority of jurisdiction? And if the court is looking at the this particular doctrine of voluntary dismissal, it's essentially the court's determination, is this sufficiently final? So it is this kind of gray area of whether it necessarily has to. I haven't seen a decision from the circuit court or other circuit courts saying you must address this. This is the same as, for example, subject matter jurisdiction. And that's why I take the position that essentially the court has the freedom to decide the Monell claim and affirm on that basis or just voluntarily dismiss the appeal.
All right. Thank you,
counsel. Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel repeated several times that we did not allege facts plausibly suggesting policymaker involvement here. This was at the beginning of the case. We had not done any discovery. We had no ability to look in behind the scenes to see who was making the decisions at Metro. We had to allege what we knew, which was that Metro was making these decisions throughout litigation.
So why didn't you go forward with your individual claims and do discovery and maybe find some new information and then seek to amend where the district court seems to have left you a window to try that?
Well, first of all, the district court did not leave us a window to do it. Under FRCP 41B, a dismissal that doesn't state otherwise is a dismissal with prejudice. The court did not state otherwise. They denied leave to amend. So that was a dismissal with prejudice. We had no reason to go back, no ability to go back. Secondly, although this court has tolerated claims solely against Doe defendants, they're highly unfavored. We had to allege what we could when we could. And what we knew was that the facts of the case plausibly suggest a policymaker was involved here. And that's because of everything we've been talking about, the litigation. I mean, Metro would have you believe that this went all the way through the Nevada Supreme Court, and there wasn't a policymaker involved here making these decisions. Even, I mean, there is Ninth Circuit case law where it says even if a policymaker is showing deliberate indifference, we have a Monell claim. Is it not deliberate indifference to have an order from the Court of Appeals saying return the laptop in 7 days and lifting the stay and not returning the property in 161 days? That plausibly suggests, more than plausibly, it suggests that that a policymaker was likely involved here. And then finally, just on the motion to dismiss on jurisdictional issues, under Microsoft, the problem there was that the voluntary dismissal retained the rights to bring back the claims after, if successful on the appeal. We voluntarily dismissed the Doe officers without any retention of rights to bring the claims again. It was not manufactured finality, it was finality. So Microsoft and its progeny are not applicable here. And with that, I'll rest.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thanks to both of you for your briefing and argument in this case. This matter is submitted.